is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Tuesday edition of the Baseball Tonight podcast for May 14th, 2019. The day after Shohei Ohtani clubbed his first homer of the year. And we're going to talk about his Angels and how they continue to creep up the standings. Plus an interesting discussion with Brewers manager Craig Counsell. And there was frustration Monday over a change in Major League Baseball policy about postponements. And we'll talk about the early favorites in the Madison Bumgarner sweepstakes. I'm Buster Olney. Our producer every day is Josh Macri. Josh, how you doing today?
Doing well, Buster. And I'd be remiss if I didn't open today by saying happy 60th birthday to my mom. Yeah.
Wow. That's great that it's your mom's birthday.
Yep.
That's really cool. When you started that, I'm like, are you looking at some calendar I'm not aware of? Because I'm not 60 and it's not my birthday.
No, Buster, it's one of the three people in my life that's more important than you. It's my mother.
Oh my God. Boy, do I feel like so low. Let's move on and let's hear Ohtani's first homer of the season against the Minnesota Twins.
Here's the pitch on Ohtani, and he swings and drives the ball deep into left center field. That one is carrying, and that ball is out of here. Shohei Ohtani gets a hold of one. That is his first home run of the season. It's a two-run shot, and the Angels have a 3-2 lead.
Terry Smith, Angels Radio, 8:30. The Angels won this game 5-4. They've won of 11 of their last 16. They have by far the fewest strikeouts in baseball with their hitters. They're a team to watch as we move forward. Diamondbacks and Pirates, and Eduardo Escobar is off to a great start.
It's a lot of opportunities. There's a drive deep right field. Cabrera goes back at the fence. It's gone. Home run Escobar. He's got the two tummies out of the way. A triple down home run. Diamondbacks add to the lead, and it goes to 7-2.
Well, Kingham out there, again, is not fooling anybody.
Greg Schulte, Arizona Sports, 98.7 FM. The final score was 9-3. Eduardo Escobar, .288 average, 8 homers, 24 RBI so far this season. It'll be interesting to see if he's going to be an all-star. The Phillies and the Brewers. This game, like a lot of the games on the East Coast affected by rain, is Monty Grandal got the Brewers started once the two teams got started.
Ground ball. That's a fair ball down the right field line. It's headed into the corner. Yelich is going to come in and score as Grandal is going to stop. And now he's going to try for third. Here's the relay thrown. It's not in time. Initially was going to be content with an RBI double. Realized Bryce Harper had some issues with it in the corner. Just kept on going. Regardless, he picks up a run batted in, and it's 2-0 Milwaukee.
620 WTMJ. But the Phillies would come back. They tied the score, and then the bottom of the seventh inning, this happened.
Swung on, hit in the air, left center field on the run in the alley. Perez going back. He won't get it. It's going to one-hop the fence, and Realmuto is into second with a double, and Segura has scored, and the Phillies have a 5-4 lead.
Scott Fransky, Sports Radio 94 WIP. Philadelphia wins 7-4. The Brewers lost on Saturday in bad weather. They lost on Sunday in bad weather, and they lost on Monday in bad weather. The White Sox beat the Indians 5-2. Yoan Moncada, man, he had a nice game.
10-01, swinging a high fly ball to left. This is crushed off the bat of Moncada. At the track, at the wall. He goes to the bullpen and left for Yoan Moncada for the second home run of the game.
Ed Farmer on WGN. The Astros playing great. Alex Bregman playing great. This is what he did against the Tigers.
1-0. And that's cranked deep to left field. Going back is Stewart at the wall. He leaps, and that ball is off the top of the wall, or is it gone? No, it is gone. A home run, a two-run shot for Bregman. Bregman, his third home run in the last 2 days, and now has 13 on the year.
Robert Ford, KBME 790 AM. Josh, if you don't have the Astros at the top of the power poll, the power 10 on Wednesday, you're out of your mind.
We'll have to wait and see for tomorrow, Buster. Wednesday is power 10 day. Maybe some debate. We'll see.
Deep center field.
The game.
It's gone!
Of the day.
And the game of the day was in Seattle. The Mariners and the Athletics. I watched a lot of this game, including what Chris Davis did early on.
Left field. Santana's going back. And that baby's gone. And that one's hit high and deep to left field. Santana's back. Santana at the wall. And that baby is gone. It's a two-homer game for Chris Davis.
Glenn Kuiper, Ray Fossey, NBC Sports California. So Oakland had a lead. Seattle hasn't been playing well. You figure this game was over. Nope. Bottom of the eighth inning, this happened.
Shot center field, barreled up, deep straightaway center, gone, off the batter's eye. Tied game, Daniel Vogelbach.
That was from Root Sports. Oakland took a lead in the top of the 10th inning to make it 5-4. The Mariners came back again.
The 2-2. Line drive, it is a fair ball. Here comes D. This game is tied.
Root Sports again, and that inning would continue.
Here we go, two balls, two strikes. The pitch to Narvaez took a lot off. Base hit left field. Here comes Santana around third. Getting a wave on. Here's the throw to the plate. Not in time. Omar Narvaez wins it with a two out. RBI single to left in the Mariners. They win it 6-5 here on this Monday night in Seattle.
Dave Sims, 710 ESPN Seattle with that call. Let's get to it.
Welcome to the show!
Welcome to the show.
Welcome to the show.
Welcome to the show.
Welcome to the show!
Welcome to the show, mate.
Welcome to the show. Whoa!
Welcome to the show, baby.
You're in the show with David Schoenfield.
David, welcome to your show. How you doing today?
I'm good, Buster. Hope you and Josh are well.
We're well, and thankfully we're inside and we're dry, which is a lot different than what we've seen with baseball so far this spring. And, you know, some interesting situations developed in recent days, which reflect apparently, from what I'm told, a new Major League Baseball policy about how games are rescheduled. I you know, was at Wrigley Field over the weekend, and Saturday, when the Cubs were playing the Brewers, it was absolutely miserable. Christian Yelich telling me how cold it was, how awful it was on Saturday playing 15 innings. And I asked him, you know, did you go up and at least change your uniform between innings? He goes, no, it's so far from the visitor clubhouse all the way down to the dugout. So, you know, they're trying to function then. On Sunday, it was just as bad. By the end of it, I was totally soaked. The temperatures were in the mid-30s. And I was a little bit surprised with the high degree of effort made to get the game in early in the year between division rivals, because you know the Cubs and the Brewers play each other later in the year, and I didn't really think that much of it. And we talked yesterday, by the way, about all the, you know, the work that the grounds crews are doing. And then last night, you had a situation at Yankee Stadium. Orioles are playing a division rival, the Yankees, and it was absolute downpour. It wasn't a very good forecast after 9 o'clock. They got the pitchers warmed up and they cleared the tarp and they were ready to go, except with all the water that had been dumped in left field, it wasn't draining very well. And so you had the managers out on the field and they're taking a look at the outfield spot and they're trying to, punch holes into the grass to help the drainage with pitchforks and this other device is going. And eventually they called the game off. And from what I understand, the directive for Major League Baseball this year is basically telling teams, look, we don't want you to schedule, take future off days and try to work those things out. Your first priority is you need to try to make up games within that series. So in other words, the Cubs and Brewers had to try to play those games within that series. The Orioles and the Yankees have to try to make up that game within that series. And they're scheduled to play a single admission doubleheader today at Yankee Stadium. And I tried to get some guidelines before the show from Major League Baseball about why this change happened. My guess is that last summer, you remember how there were so many rainouts early and teams like the Cubs were at the ballpark for 50 straight days. From the union's perspective, that's a problem to have players not having off days. And I wonder if this is just an adjustment from that. But the collateral damage, of course, is it might put the players in a better situation to protect their off days. But then you have situations like last night where the fans are sitting in the rain and sitting in these miserable conditions. Same thing at Wrigley Field over the weekend. What do you make of all that?
It's terrible. I live in Connecticut in between Boston and New York. We had 21 days of rain in April and already like 8 or 9 this month. So The weather in the Northeast has been miserable. The weather in the Midwest has been miserable. It's been cold. That game last night on ESPN in Philadelphia with a rain delay, 48 degrees. I mean, it's middle of May, and players are still wearing ski masks out there. That's how terrible it's been. There was a game last week, I think it was Yankees-Mariners at Yankee Stadium, and they played at least two innings in an absolute downpour before they finally brought the tarp on the field. So, yeah, I know the players don't want 50 days in a row with games, but I don't think it's good for them to be playing in these downpours either, and certainly it's terrible for the fans.
Yeah, I was thinking about that last night. Aaron Hicks just came off the disabled list. The Yankees have had all these injuries, and that outfield was a complete mess. And if you were Aaron Boone and they had actually played that game last night, you would have hesitated probably to play him out in the outfield. I looked for some direction from Major League Baseball before we started the show. I wasn't able to get it about exactly what the guidelines are. I feel like that when you have a situation, when you have division rivals playing each other and they play all these games and you can punt on a game in early May, then do it. You know what I mean? I mean, if you're going to play a single admission doubleheader, why not do it in June or July or August?
Yeah, no, I agree with you. It's one thing if it's Cubs Cardinals or Cubs Brewers and you know they have four more series. I get it. If it's an interleague game or two teams playing in their final game of the series, of course you have to try to make it up. And yeah, we've already seen several split doubleheaders this year. It's kind of a no-win situation, you know, because you're either going to mess with the fans, mess with the schedule. You can't predict the weather, and as bad as it was last year, it's been even worse this year. Maybe baseball just needs to cut down on the schedule. How about 144-game schedule?
With more off days built in where you could make up for rainouts, potentially, like we saw. Josh, you speak for the fan here. How do you feel when you see the details of how this is playing out so far this year?
Cold. Raw. I don't like it.
Yeah. Wow, there's some deep insight. No,
yeah, exactly.
The more that I thought about, Dave, and I agree with you, I think MLB is kind of in a no-win situation, but I do think the number one priority should be the fan comfort, because I'm telling you, those games in Wrigley Field, that was awful. Like, I tip of the cap to the Cubs fans who sat, and the Brewers fans who sat through those 2 days. It was terrible.
Yeah, look, nobody wants to go to a cold, wet, rainy game. And, you know, hey, we know attendance is down a little bit this year. That's certainly a big reason why. You know, nobody wants to sit in the stands in your winter parka watching a baseball game. So, yeah, I'm with you. You got to place a higher priority on fan comfort.
I wrote yesterday about Madison Bumgarner and how he's available right now for any team interested in trading for a starting pitcher. And I have a piece coming up on ESPN.com today, sort of ranking the teams in order as I see them as early favorites. It's like setting a Kentucky Derby field like in February, okay? And I want to get your input, your criticism, your feedback on this. My team's in order. I've got number one, San Diego Padres. And you and I both know that a decade ago, long-standing baseball tradition, you don't trade one of your best players in the division. We know Farhan Zaidi, who worked for Billy Bean, he's not going to care about that. He's going to want the best prospects in return, and the Padres have the best prospects. They have a need, especially as the summer goes along and Chris Paddock's innings might run out. I think the Padres would be number one. I got the Cardinals at number two. They could use a left-hander. The Phillies at number three, they have a need, but they probably don't have as much in the way of prospects as other teams. I got the Astros at four. I heard from evaluators about the Astros. You know what? From their perspective, with Gerrit Cole headed into free agency in the fall, maybe you trade for Bumgarner. You show him how great it is. You show him how you can help him with analytics a little bit, and you convince him to stay the way they did with Justin Verlander. Number five, I've got the Brewers. I think based on need, they might be number one, but we've learned about David Stearns. He doesn't like to pay sticker price on anything. And if Madison Bumgarner is going to be the most expensive guy in the trade market, it's hard to imagine that David Stearns would pay that price. I also have the Twins, Yankees, Red Sox, Braves, Angels listed below them. Do you agree with the top of my list, or, you know, shoot, take shots at it?
Yeah, no, I like the Padres idea, although I'm just not sure they have staying power over the course of the season, and if you don't have a guarantee that you can re-sign them, I don't know. But you're right. They're so deep in prospects, they could give up, you know, 3 second-tier kind of guys and get them. So, yeah, I like that idea. I really think Houston might be the team. They don't need them to win the division. They're going to run away with that. But they've kind of struggled with the back of that rotation, although we saw Corbin Martin come up on Sunday and make a really impressive Major League debut. But, man, if you can roll into the playoffs with Verlander, Cole, and Bumgarner, I mean, holy cow, that's a great top three to have in October. And they still have a pretty good farm system as well. So I think I might put Houston number one. But like you said, there's so many teams that need starting pitching right now. Everybody's hitting so many home runs. All these pitchers are giving up so many home runs. Of course you want a guy like Bumgarner. But, yeah, I like Astros and Padres would be my top two on that list.
And doesn't it feel like Bumgarner should wind up with a team where they wear a lot of cowboy hats at the ballpark, right?
I think he would fit right in Texas, right? He's got his big ranch out in North Carolina. There's more land probably available in Texas than any other state. The Astros could throw in a cattle ranch or something to entice him to come to Houston.
Speaking of the Astros, I told Josh at the top of the show that if he doesn't have the Astros number one in the Power 10, he's out of his mind. What do you think?
Well, I mean, they've hit 30 home runs their past 10 games. They hit four more last night. You know, Matthew Boyd was on a roll coming into that game. They knocked him out in four innings. I think he threw around 90 pitches in four innings. They're just absolutely on fire. I have a piece up today using one of these advanced metrics, weighted runs created. We won't try to explain it, but by that metric, right now, they're on pace for the greatest offense of all time. In fact, Buster, you'll love this. They're slugging .507. No team in the live ball era has slugged .500 over an entire season. I don't know if they can keep it up. They have a couple, you know, backup guys on fire, like Jake Mariznick. But, you know, Springer having a great year, MVP candidate. Carlos Correa looks healthy again. They are just absolutely crushing the ball right now.
Our old friend Steve Phillips tweeted out this morning, the Mets former Mets general manager, the Astros have the best offense in baseball. They have a circular lineup with no beginning or end. They are all the same guys. Reminds me of the great Yankee lineups from the late 90s, early 2000s. Dave, I covered that team, and that was always what stood out, that at the bottom you had Scott Brosius driving in 98 runs or Tim Raines or Strawberry hitting seventh. You think that's a fair comparison?
Yeah, I like it. You know, no doubt about those Yankees. It was the depth more than, you know, the superstars in that lineup. You know, Jeter was probably their best all-around offensive player, but they didn't have guys bashing 30-plus homers, right, on a consistent basis. Tino had one big year in there. The thing this team has is if George Springer keeps playing like this, you know, and we've always felt he's kind of had this. He had a monster first half back in 2017 when he hit 27 home runs, had injuries last year. You know, that gives them, you know, that MVP kind of guy. Altuve looks like he maybe isn't quite that player anymore. But, yeah, the great lineups of all time, it's the depth, you know, that makes them so great. And that's what those Yankees teams had, and that's what this team has.
And there's no question the Astros are the favorites to win the American League West. But I got to tell you, I am intrigued by watching the Angels in recent days. They've now won 11 of their last 16. And this is a team that's so different than other teams because they do not strike out. Not only do they have Mike Trout in the middle at the top of their lineup at batting second and doing his damage. Otani is back, hits his first home run last night, and they put the ball in play. And we've seen in recent years, teams that have success in the postseason tend to be the teams that don't strike out a lot. I don't know if the Angels are going to get there. I certainly don't think they're going to win the division, but I do feel like there's a chance as, you know, Otani gets settled in and eventually they get Justin Upton back and there are fewer bats for Albert Pujols. This team is improving. What do you think?
No, I would agree. I was thinking about them the other day and my thoughts align with yours. I know they got to figure out the pitching staff, but you're right. They played all this, you know, this far into the season without Upton and Otani just with a few games, that lineup's going to be a lot deeper with those two. That rest of that division, like, you know, we're seeing the Mariners fall apart. The Rangers can't pitch. The A's are not last year's A's. So are going to be in a pretty weak division. If they can beat up on the Mariners, Rangers, and A's, I think they have a chance to join that wild card race. I'm with you there.
All right. I thought of you when I saw this Bleacher tweet that came in. Aaron at Love of Baseball asks, 1 month in, we have some exciting storylines. In your opinion, what was the greatest Major League Baseball season in its entirety from opening day through the World Series, and what made that season so spectacular? Dave, I'll give you first crack at that one.
Okay, well, my dream has always been to write like a 20,000-word article looking at every season of Major League history someday. I wrote three down, 2001, 1988, but how about 1998? Look at this, Buster. You got McGuire and Sosa. Huge deal at the time. Yankees win 114. Kerry Wood strikes out 20. That's the year the Dodgers trade Mike Piazza. The Mariners trade Randy Johnson. David Wells has a perfect game. The Orioles and Yankees had that memorable Tino Martinez, Armando Benitez brawl. Cal Ripken's streak ends. Unbelievable season. The only thing it's lacking, you didn't have a great World Series. The Yankees swept the Padres. And you can argue any great season needs a great postseason. But 1998, what a season.
Yeah, and I feel like you're pandering to me, right? Because I covered the 98 Yankees. I was there for the Benitez fight. The anniversary of that actually is coming up here later this week. That was, never forget that. Watching that team that year was pretty incredible. And it's interesting, you mentioned 2001. I get this question a lot when I, you know, go and talk to colleges or you speak to journalism students and they ask the question, what was the most amazing thing you ever covered? And I always have to sort of qualify my answer by saying, I want to make this clear. This 2001 would be the answer, but obviously it's something you would hope never happens again, that the context is never the same again.
Yeah.
Because the way that season played out, and then 9/11 happens and everything that happened after that and, you know, all the emotion and that incredible World Series between the Diamondbacks and the Yankees and the Diamondbacks win it at the end. It was amazing, to see the response to the Yankees in New York in the aftermath of 9/11, and the baseball was amazing. But, it was heartbreaking as well. And I never forget that, that year during the postseason, one of our great photographers who worked at the New York Times was traveling to cover the playoffs and World Series, and he didn't seem like himself. And I asked him, like, hey, how you doing? And he told me about how he had been down near the Twin Towers on 9/11, and he was taking pictures, and he'd taken a number of shots of people who were leaping out of the building, and he couldn't bring himself to open them up, because he felt like he was invading their privacy. And so you have this guy who, you know, is taking these unbelievable baseball pictures, and on the other hand, he's still haunted by everything that had happened on 9/11, and it felt like everything was wrapped together that fall.
Yeah, I was fortunate enough to cover that World Series as well, and I'll never forget one of those unbelievable games at Yankee Stadium, and I was out in the Ox Box in right field, and you know, whether it was Jeter's home run or the Brocious game, I forget which one, probably all of them, right? Sinatra playing over the loudspeaker over and over at the end of the game. And the Yankee fan, nobody left the stadium, just standing there singing for 20, 30 minutes. To me, it's the most memorable, emotional moment I've ever had. And I know I was there as a reporter, but just as a baseball fan, nothing will ever touch that moment. Yeah, and then, 2001, you get Game 7 as well, and the Mariners 116. Bond set the home run record. Pujols and Ichiro's rookie seasons are certainly an argument for everything that season encompasses as the best ever.
And you'll remember this. The Mariners won 116 games, but as the Yankees were beating them in five games in Yankee Stadium, they were serenading former Yankee Lou Piniella, who's the manager of the Mariners. And Lou had this little smile on his face.
Yep.
And he said after the game, after they were eliminated, I'm happy for those people.
Yep.
Like, and he was happy that folks in New York had that moment.
No, and it's true. And if you remember, Piniella had pushed that team all season to break the record. In retrospect, maybe that he would have backed off a little in September, And of course, they, you know, there was the week without baseball after 9/11, so they kind of lost their momentum and their steam down the stretch. But yeah, Lou felt so much for the people of New York. It's almost like he didn't mind losing that series, as great as that Mariners team was.
Yeah, some of the other seasons I thought of, 1967, as you know, the American League pennant race was absolutely insane. 1969, you know, the emergence of the New York Mets, and yep. then they faced the Baltimore Orioles in the World Series. That was a fantastic year. We heard from Wayne Coffey about his new book last month, talking about that 1969 team. Josh, I know you have a nomination as well.
Yeah, and I... All your years are really good, especially 98. I remember 98 as a kid, really kind of coming into my own as a baseball fan, how exciting that was, notably the home run chase. But the first thing that came to my mind when I saw this question was actually 1941. I mean, especially, you know, just kind of thinking about the roles that we're in right now, Buster. Can you imagine doing the podcast in 1941 when you have Ted
wow.
Williams chasing 400, you have the DiMaggio hit streak? Those would be some good shows.
Yeah, the anniversary of DiMaggio's hitting streak is actually tomorrow. That would be amazing. And then imagine the fights we would have about the MVP award.
I know, exactly.
You know, Ted Williams hits 406 and he doesn't win the MVP. How about that? Yeah, so you're right. 1941 would have been absolutely spectacular. Dave, you've also got a piece about where pitching comes from. And in researching that piece, you dug out something really interesting on the hapless Miami Marlins.
Well, Buster, Josh, tell me if you guys would think this rotation might work in 2019. Chris Paddock, Luis Castillo, Domingo Herman, Trevor Williams, throw in Caleb Smith, but those first four guys, the Marlins
gosh.
Once had all of them. They traded them all away, basically got nothing for any of those four guys. Well, now we know why. One reason, they're one of the worst teams in baseball.
Yeah, and it's not like, you know, these guys were just like pieces to some of those other bigger trades. It was like they have gone through a series of bad position player trades and bad pitching trades.
Yeah, we always talk about, oh, they traded Yelich and Stanton and Ozuna, but we forget they had these guys, Chris Paddock, they traded him for Fernando Rodney, Luis Castillo, they were looking for starting pitching after Jose Fernandez's death, they traded him for Dan Straley. Herman, he was a young minor leaguer. They traded him to the Yankees. Trevor Williams, who's a really good pitcher with the Pirates, he actually was compensation when they signed Jim Benedict as he was the Pirates' pitching guru coordinator. So they gave Williams his compensation, and Benedict, I think, he only lasted 2 years with the Marlins. So four really good young pitchers, and right now you have nothing to show for those four guys on your major league
yeah.
roster.
Yeah, and just for transparency's sake, some of the debacle trades were made before Derek Jeter came on board, and some of them
right.
have been made since. It's
yeah.
It's not all just happening under his watch. Dave, thanks for doing this. You
right,
know, wherever you watch baseball, make sure you have a poncho on, okay?
Yeah, no doubt.
We'll be back in a moment with Craig Counsell, but first I want to tell you about SeatGeek. Do you ever feel like ticketing websites make getting to the event difficult on purpose? It's as if they're so big they can get away with not caring about the customer experience. So what if their site's annoying and doesn't have the events you want? Hello, status quo. The real question is, how easy could it be if those ticketing sites actually cared? With millions of live event tickets and price match guarantee, SeatGeek proves there's a better way. Search sports, live music, comedy, and more. SeatGeek has the tickets you're looking for all in one place. In an industry that tends to stagnate, SeatGeek decided to stand out from the crowd. They built the fastest way to find tickets, so you can stop searching for the perfect seat and start enjoying it. Why is SeatGeek better than the rest? A quick look at the App Store shows over 50,000 five-star reviews. How's that for customer satisfaction? It's a better process. SeatGeek pulls together millions of tickets from all over the web. Then it rates each deal on a scale of 1 to 10. Finally, SeatGeek displays them on an interactive seat map. SeatGeek breaks down the details. Green dot means good deals. Red dots are overpriced. And every purchase is fully guaranteed, so you can shop for tickets with confidence. SeatGeek is clearly the fastest and easiest way to find tickets. In fact, I've just used the app to buy tickets to, believe it or not, Josh, little Panthers game, but you can't tell my son that because they're playing the Titans first week of November. I told you I'm planning a big sports weekend for my son Jake and I. as soon as the World Series is over, and he's a weird kid, so he roots for the Titans, and we're going to go to there. And, you know, his other favorite team, his favorite NBA team, is the Charlotte Hornets.
Wow.
How about that?
How about that? Did you spend some time in Carolina a decade and a half ago, Buster? That's strange.
Wow. Man. We're going to move on from that comment. SeatGeek will even give you $10 off your first SeatGeek purchase. All you need to do is use their promo code. Just for the record, my son is on the up and up. Like, he was created on the up and up.
There
okay?
you go. There you go. Fair enough.
Download the SeatGeek app today and use promo code Buster for $10 off on your first purchase. That's promo code Buster for $10 off on your first purchase. Thank God my wife doesn't listen to this podcast. All right. So over the weekend, Bukshambi caught up with Craig Council, the Brewers manager. Always an interesting lesson.
You guys won the division last year. You ended up getting all the way to game 7 of the LCS. And one of the things with your team, a lower payroll team, you attack things kind of a unique style, especially how you use your pitching. Give me both manager and player perspective, because when you came up and when you were playing, relievers had roles that were a little more specific. And now you talk about, you have arguably the best reliever in the sport. He is not your closer in Hader. You've referred to him as outgetter from time to time. But when you came up, guys may not have been quite so comfortable. Your best reliever probably wanted to pitch the final three outs of the game.
You know, one thing I've learned this year is that your bullpen changes every year, and you got to be ready to adapt quickly as the manager. But, you know, we try to put Josh into the most important parts of the game. So just to figure out what the most important parts of the game are is what we're trying to do. Now, we also have to balance that with his health, and because there's an important part of the game every single day, but his health still matters, and we have to get him rest and to make him as effective as he is. So this year it's trended towards the back of the game, and it's been a way for us to really get him some rest, because you're not going to win every single game. You're not going to have that spot in the sixth inning where it's tied. So it's been a way to get us some rest and make sure he's healthy. But ultimately, as we move forward and as we get deeper, and as Jeremy Jeffers kind of gets clicking again, I think you could see Josh kind of moving a little bit forward in the game.
Let's talk Christian Yelich for a second. MVP a season ago, second half, he was unbelievable. You and I had a conversation in spring training, and I asked you about, you know, some of the concerns for your team or what you'd be looking at. One of the things I suggested was, well, you can't expect Yelich to be Superman again this year. And you said, oh, no, he's going to be Superman again this year. Tell me what you saw last year in the second half and just sort of his development as a player, watching him on the other side, watching him last year and the progress he's made with you guys.
Yeah, it's just a player that's taken a big step forward, and then he's kind of closed the door that what was behind him. So he's not going back on the other side of that door. And, you know, I've watched tape from him early in last year, and he looks like a different hitter to me. And it's not, I don't think, visually really obvious, but, you know, the things he's doing better is that he's attacking the first pitch with greater frequency and definitely more impact. And I think the biggest thing is he's just learned his swing. You know, it takes players, and especially I think this is, you know, he's a taller player with long levers, a little just to learn how to their power and learn. He's always had tremendous raw power, but learning how to put the ball in the air to the pull side and to center field has just taken him a little bit. And it finally clicked for him basically the second half of last year. And he found some comfort level with his swing. And now the ball is going in the air a lot more. And he hits the ball so hard that when he puts it in the air, it's going to go out of the park. So it's just a great natural evolution of a talented hitter. That's what we've seen. It isn't like mystery or isn't some great huge swing change. It's really fun watching a hitter just evolve into a better form of himself, and that's what Christian's done.
Good stuff. Good to see you.
Thanks, Boog.
We'll be back in a moment with Sarah Langs, but first I want to tell you about DXL. Listen up, guys. If you're big or tall, you know what a pain it is to find clothes that fit. So a trip to DXL needs to be on your to-do list. At DXL, big and tall is all they do. They've spent years developing their own sizing patterns to make sure big guys get a comfortable fit every time. Pair that with over 100 brands, and you've got the one-stop shop for men's big and tall. Whether you're looking for jeans, hoodies, suits, or shoes, DXL's got you covered for every occasion in stores or online at DXL.com. DXL Big and Tall, built for you at DXL.com.
Numbers Game.
Sarah Langs is a reporter and a producer for MLB.com. And Sarah, I'm just wondering, you know, last couple times we've talked to you in the background, it sounds like somebody's making breakfast. What's that all about?
Yeah, so I've been chatting with you a couple of these times from the office here at MLB.com, and I'm new, and I don't really know how conference rooms work or any of that. So I had been sitting in like a kind of break area, which is really not that high traffic, but the high traffic is at like, you know, 9 a.m. when people are getting in, making their breakfast, getting their coffee. But today I found a conference room and I just went in it. So hopefully nobody will kick me out.
Yeah, so we have baggage claim Mondays, and now we need breakfast Tuesdays and Thursdays. Are you getting the same weird looks that I get when I'm at the airport when you're sort of talking baseball to yourself and they're wondering what the heck is that all about?
Very much so. I was getting a lot of looks, so I'm glad to be in this conference room right now.
All right, let's play the numbers game.
Number three.
Number three is 56.8%. That's George Springer's hard hit rate this season. Last year, it was just 37.2% for the year. His increase is the highest of any player with at least 300 batted balls last year and at least 50 this year. And he's third in the majors overall in hard hit rate. And he's not really a guy we used to think of in that sort of, you know, Joey Gallo, Aaron Judge kind of company. But he's doing that. So how is he doing it? He's swinging at the first pitch about 10 percentage points more frequently this year and having really good results on it, which I thought was really interesting because usually when a guy's swinging at the first pitch more, he's more impatient and it's not what you want to see, but it's working and paying dividends for him. And he's crushing breaking balls with an .804 slugging percentage on them, which leads the majors by a very wide margin. And I just looked at this right before we came on. He has 2.6 WAR already. He had 2.7 last year, so he's 0.1 away. And that went up by like 0.3 overnight. His career high is 5.1 in 2016. So he's just having a crazy all-around year, and he's doing it by just demolishing the ball.
Number two.
Number two is 130. That's Chris Paddock's opponent batting average this year in his first seven starts of his career. Elias tells us that that's the lowest of any pitcher in the modern era in his first seven starts among pitchers to face at least 50 batters in those starts because otherwise Ryan Stanek shows up. But think about that. Any pitcher, think of all of the great pitchers to pitch since 1900, all the great phenoms who had a great first year. Chris Paddock has been better than all of them, at least by opponent batting average. And he and his 1.55 ERA and 0.69 whip will face Clayton Kershaw tonight. And did you guys know that Kershaw had a 4.36 ERA in his first seven career starts? Obviously, he got a lot better after that.
Number one.
Number one is 54. That's how many strikeouts Bryce Harper has this season. It's tied for the most in the majors with Jorge Soler and Mitch Haniger. It's by far the most strikeouts Harper has ever had in his team's first 40 games of a season. It's 13 more. He had 41 in 2015, which worked out pretty well for him. And it's tied for the third most by a Phillies player in the team's first 40 games. Ryan Howard had a season with 56, and Mike Schmidt had a season with 55. Harper's hitting .222, which is also his worst through 40 team games. His prior lowest was .229 last year. I dare say we may be seeing a trend developing with Mr. Harper.
Yeah, and I'll ask Sarah, you and Josh this question. Among these three players I'm going to name who have struggled so far this year, Bryce Harper, Vladimir Guerrero Jr., Joey Votto, which of those three are the most concerned about? Josh, I'll start with you.
Well, I'm no dork, so I'm not going to look at numbers for anything. But you know, I'm just going to say for this year, I think it's probably Vlad Jr., just because of the inexperience. I don't necessarily have the faith that he can get himself out of it this season. I think he's going to be fine long term, obviously, but for this year, I'd say Vlad Jr.
Wow. Okay. You're wrong. Sarah, go ahead.
I would say Harper. I just think that this is not, you know, the first year that he would have wanted in Philly. And if you look at what he's done in his career, and I've said it many times, but if you look at his career, aside from that MVP season, it hasn't been that great. And now he's performing even below that kind of career average level. So I would just be concerned about that and concerned about what Phillies fans and Phillies front office think about, you know, the fact that he's there for another 13 years, you know, including this year. I think obviously it's concerning for Vlad, but I do think he'll be fine. I think what Josh said makes sense that, you know, I don't know if he gets himself out of this in the majors at this level, but he's not seeing a lot of pitches in the zone. He's getting pitched like a crazy way for a 20-year-old who just got called up. So I'm not that concerned about him, but I am concerned about Harper.
Yeah, Josh, can you chime in here with a right answer ding for me? Okay. One of the, yeah, thank you. That was Sarah's answer when she picked Bryce Harper. 100%. I'm not worried about Joey Votto yet. I was watching a Giants broadcast recently. I think it was Mike Kruko, maybe, Dwayne Kuiper. They were talking about how Votto's had streaks in the past where he hasn't looked as good, and eventually he figures it out and he hits, and he's getting older, but I still want to give him some time. I think Vlad Jr. with his ground ball rate tells you he's still dealing with the adrenaline of being a young player. I know the Blue Jays are happy with the at-bats that he's had, generally speaking. He eventually comes around. What I'm worried about with Harper is just knowing how much pressure he puts on himself. And you wonder, first year of a 13-year deal, how that will start to manifest with all those strikeouts and how that starts to wear on him. I'm curious about how he handles that, Josh. That's why I think the answer is Harper.
Okay. Yeah.
All right.
There you go.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. We're right and you're wrong. Okay. Thanks, Sarah.
Thanks for having me, Buster.
Thank you, Sarah. Hey. Oh, man.
You okay?
Yeah. Choked on my coffee. That's why I couldn't really rebut because I couldn't breathe.
I know.
Fine. Fair enough.
You're right. Yeah. Okay. You're good. I was like, man, that was a surrender right there.
Exactly.
Bleacher tweets.
All right, Buster. We got to one with Mr. Schoenfield already. Let's get to the rest. This one from Jason Amico at Jason Amico. Jason wants to know who'll be the most enticing starting pitcher that a contender lands at the trade deadline besides Madison Bumgarner.
Well, and there could be some interesting names out there. Marcus Stroman, Aaron Sanchez, we've talked about. I think the most interesting name, who I think is going to be moved, is Trevor Bauer, who is right in the prime of his career. We've talked about how the Indians have to manage payroll. The Twins have a nice little lead at the beginning of the season. If they start to move away, I think it makes it easier for the Indians to flip Bauer for trade assets during the year.
Next one is Don Irvine at Don Irvine, coming to us from the Beltway, wants to know what are the chances that the Nats could actually have a worse record than the Orioles at any point this season?
See, when I prepared for the podcast, I didn't see that qualifier at any point. Okay. So now I'm going to go back and take a look at the records. The Orioles are 14-26, the Nationals 16. So right now the Orioles are two games behind the Nationals. No, they're never going to catch them.
No, I agree. And that doesn't mean the Nationals, that doesn't mean the Nationals are good. That just means the Orioles aren't going to,
Not trying to win.
Right.
And they're not trying to win this year.
Exactly.
They're rebuilding.
Exactly. You get a two game cushion on the Orioles. You're safe.
It didn't make me Johnny Super
Scout. No, it doesn't. Jim
Meisner. We
got to
get Buck on at some point, by the way.
We do have to get Buck on. Jim Meisner is at Jim Meisner 87 says, guys, put on your commissioner's hats for the day. What are the two cities you'd want to put expansion teams in to get up to 32 teams with four divisions in each league? Jim suggests Calgary and Salt Lake City. What say you, Buster?
Well, I'll let you answer first because you already know my answer, okay? You know my biases and you know how my mind thinks. Give me your two first.
Well, I know Nashville is one of yours. What's the second?
I would go because I think eventually Portland is going. They're going to need to balance out the divisions, and I think Portland makes a lot of sense. But, yeah, those would be the two teams.
I'm with you on Nashville. I love Nashville. Obviously, I haven't spent as much time there as you have, but I'm in love with that city. So give me Nashville. And just to change it up a little bit, I'm with you. You got to get another team on the West Coast, but let's go north of the border. Let's go Nashville and Vancouver. What do you think of that?
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. Justin Morneau's hometown.
That's right.
Absolutely. And by the way, they really can't entertain this idea until they get the ballpark situation settled. Look, I'm worried about the Marlins franchise and the direction that it's going in. We know the Rays are struggling with their ballpark situation. And this news broke last night, San Francisco Chronicle reporting that the Port Commission out in the Bay Area voted unanimously to approve the tentative term sheet for the A's new ballpark stadium at Howard Terminal. So, Josh, I know that news gets you excited. Then this sentence put everything into context. This gives the A's 4 years to complete an environmental impact report.
Yes. Love environmental impact reports.
Oh, so you know what? Check back in about six decades.
Exactly. Speaking of ballparks, Buster, let's close out with this one from P.K. Steinberg at P.K. Steinberg. Name your most intimidating ballparks to play in 2019.
Well, and I'll just parrot what I've heard from players through the years. They say that you will hear things from fans in Boston, Philadelphia, and Yankee Stadium that you will not hear in other ballparks. I'm going to give you an underrated, intimidating ballpark. The ballpark in Oakland.
Yeah, I was just
like,
I think the
folks there are great.
Yep.
They're a little nuts. They're a little crazy. It's a different type of place. I think there's, intimidating might not be the perfect word, but I think it gets under opponent's skin. What do you think?
Yeah, not only that, but just think about the dimensions in Oakland. I mean, you have about 75 acres of foul territory, great for pitchers, but if you're standing up there in the box, you're like, I'm gonna get out. I'm just gonna get out, you know, so it's...
And if you get a bunch of rain, then your sewage comes up through the clubhouse floor, and that's always a good thing.
That too. Not a good situation. Not a good situation. Good bleacher tweets, though. Keep them coming. Use the hashtag bleacher tweets.
That's it for today. My thanks to Craig Council and Boog Shambi for that wonderful conversation. Sarah Lang's in the show, Dave Schoenfield, and Josh Macri, who produces this podcast every day. Have a great day, everybody. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.